My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking to Harriet Scott Chessman. Harriet, how you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much.
You look good. The title of your book is The Beauty of Ordinary Things. It's published by Atelier 26, which is a publisher here in Portland. A couple of things about this book that interested me. One is that it deals with very serious subjects in a non-serious, non-pretentious, non-literary novel kind of a way. Would you agree with that?
Thank you. Yes, I think I know what you mean, because I really in this particular story wanted to achieve a kind of lightness of a kind of a light and air in the space of the narrative, but I was definitely trying to get at some very deep, serious things.
Mm-hmm. Now this is something that always occurs to me because I look for it. But
yeah.
Have you read much James Joyce?
Yes, I love James Joyce.
Well, you
except
know,
I haven't read more than
Finnegan's
a couple.
Wake.
Yeah.
I'll try Finnegan's Wake sometime.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But I have read Ulysses, and I have
yes.
read Portrait of the Artist as Young
yes,
Man.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there's a concept of Joycean guilt, which I find running through this book.
Oh.
You know,
yeah.
Stephen Dedalus had this burden of guilt
Absolutely.
On him because he refused to pray with his mother at her deathbed.
Yes.
And there's a couple of characters in here who are carrying a similar kind of guilt, aren't they?
Yes. Actually, you know, it's funny. I didn't think of that word guilt as I was writing. But when I look back on the book, I do realize that my character, Benny Finn, especially, is carrying a sense of, well, you could say survivor's guilt. But I also think it's a particular brand of kind of Irish Catholic sense of not having acted well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And
regretting it and
yeah.
kind of dwelling on it.
I think it's a kind of,
and I shouldn't simply say Irish Catholic because I have to say right up front, I myself am not Catholic.
And yet
I have a lot of regret myself, and yeah. I have a tendency to look back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you don't have to be Irish or Jewish to feel guilt. And the fact is that Benny Finn rejects everything Catholic. He doesn't.
You know, it's interesting. I felt that he does, and yet he really doesn't. He as he says, it's as close to his Catholicism is as close to him as his skin.
Mm-hmm. So we're probably delving too deep into it. This is
yeah.
really about four people. It's a very
yeah.
small group of people that we're dealing with.
Yes.
Four people and some of the people they touch. It's the Finn family, particularly Liam and Benny.
Mm-hmm.
It's Isabel, who's Liam's girlfriend, eventually Liam's wife,
mm-hmm.
and a woman named Sister Claire, who's really Helen Barry.
Yes,
who is friends. She's linked to both sets of people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the book starts. She's a novice. She's
yes.
not yet been taken final vows.
Yeah.
And the book starts with a dream of rescue.
Yes.
Talk about that, please.
Well, actually, I came to Sister Claire as a character quite late in the writing of this book. And I came to that dream quite late. But I did feel it was a great place to open, finally. And yes, I imagine her writing this in a journal in the middle of the night, right before Matins, which is, you know, the Gregorian chant office in the middle of the night, around 1:20 in the morning, she's writing. And the dream involves a soldier. It involves discovering that she's in the middle of a war and going up to a rooftop and being very, very worried. And a soldier angel comes to the roof and picks her up and takes her away, flying.
And it's funny because she's about, of the four major characters in the book, she's probably the most content, or at least we think so, at the beginning of the book.
Yes, that's true.
She's apparently the most content in any case.
Yes, I think she is definitely struggling, and she's not totally certain about going forward and making her first vows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her vows are going to be on the Feast of the Epiphany, too.
Boy, as it ends up.
You really set that up.
There's a little Joyce for you.
the Finns are a large family. There's a bunch of kids. We generally were focusing on Benny and Liam. Liam goes off to Yale.
Yes.
And Benny goes off to Vietnam.
Yes.
And when Benny comes back, like a lot of people come back from any wars, he's not right anymore. He feels guilty. He feels damaged.
Yes.
He feels as though he's let everybody down, including himself. He has a friend named Mike Saltis. And he feels he's let him. I mean, the guy is just carrying this huge burden.
Yes.
What really is bothering Benny?
I actually think he doesn't realize this yet, but I think that he is carrying a sense of the world itself being wrong. That he is thinking of it personally, and yet I think as he continues, he will start to see that he's okay. He has acted as well as he could, but that the world is crazy. War is crazy. He was involved in it, right in the middle of it. There was not much he could do.
Mm-hmm. And again, he's a character. All four of these characters kind of symbolize something, not in the, you know, the clunky Christ symbols in Moby Dick kind of a way, but
I would love to hear what you think they might symbolize. I don't think of them as symbolizing, but I'm always really interested in design and architecture somehow.
Well, it seems to me that Benny represents in some level a path to redemption.
Yes.
And
I think that's true.
And that Sister Claire represents in some way that answers are not right for everyone. And Liam is, he does the best of all of them in the sense that he's doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing. And yet that's not necessarily the most satisfying thing in the world either.
You're the first Liam advocate I've met. I'm glad for that.
Yeah. And Isabel, she's in some way the emotional fulcrum in the book, because everybody relates to her.
Yes,
in
that's
some
true.
Way.
I think she's the connector for everybody.
Yes, but not just the connector. I mean, everybody sees her as a friend, a confidant, the purest one of the group.
Wow, that's so interesting. I love that. I love that interpretation, Ed. I really do.
Well, hey, you know, you put it in the book. Kinky Friedman once told me that people were always finding more in his books than he was putting into them. So, but in this case, I think this is what's happening.
I love that.
Let's see. Now, Liam's at Yale. Isabel is at sixes and sevens. She doesn't really know what she's doing, so she starts painting.
Yes.
Right?
She's at Yale, too.
Yeah, she's at Yale, too. That's of course they are. And she also starts to work in an old age home.
Yes, for the summer job. A summer job. I have to confess, this is not at all autobiographical, this book, but that is autobiographical. I worked in a nursing home one summer in 1969 in Boston. And in fact, I lived in an apartment on Mass Ave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wished I had someone driving me to work, because I had to take the bus into the station and come out on Commonwealth Avenue.
Well, it's not so bad.
Yeah, I know.
Except in the wintertime.
Exactly. It was summer, hot summer.
Oh, okay. Because every time I've been in Boston in the winter, they always tell me it's the worst winter in 40 years.
Oh, I know. They always say that.
They always say that, yeah. Benny finds a little job with a man named Mr. Gottschalk.
Gottschalk, yes.
One of my favorite composers of all time.
Oh!
Louis Moreau Gottschalk.
Oh, my gosh.
But he winds up working in a children's hospital, which is on some level very satisfying for him, but on some level not. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, two things. One, he's simply an orderly because he didn't graduate from college. He left college in the middle and then got drafted and never went back. So in a sense, it's a very simple kind of a little bit of a grind of a job. And yet also he has to watch a lot of kids, let's say on the oncology ward, you know, a lot of children with very serious illnesses, and some of them die. And so in a sense, he's placed himself right in a place where he's constantly reminded of grief and of loss of something precious.
Yeah, it's not exactly the best place for a guy like him. Although,
you know, in a funny way, yes. Actually, you know what? I've never talked to anyone about this, but I think it's in a way he can always hope that he can make a difference to some child's life.
Okay, now
to
I talked
some child.
Yeah, I talked about Joycelyn guilt before. Isabel has guilt about her mother.
Yes.
And about an older woman who died in the in the nursing home, who they knew as the woman who sang Albert Mooney.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
Oh, man. Well, actually, I have to say, this also was based on a woman I knew in that nursing home, Molly Driscoll. Her name actually was Molly Driscoll, and I gave her that name in this book. But what I hoped to bring across was that for Isabel, she became quite attached to figures, to people like this, this wonderful woman who taught her these Irish songs and who would sing in the bathtub and when she was trying to give her a bath. And for Isabel, it's that she comes into work one day and Molly is just gone. She has died. But more than that, because Isabel had taken a couple days off, there's nothing in her room. There's no sign of her. And I think this is actually probably something that is very deep in the whole book, is just the sorrow of life and death, the way they can happen. So I guess that's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. At some level, are the people in your book people who have difficulty understanding that life is full of stuff like this? They can't have come to terms with it?
I think that's a very good way of looking at it. I would say that at some level they're railing against that. Or let's say they almost can't believe it, so they're pushing back against it.
Go not gentle into that
dark
night.
A funny way.
Yeah. So now we know why Isabel feels guilty. You want to tell us about her mother, or do you want to save that for people who read the book?
This is not a very plot-heavy book, so I think I can mention it. It's just that her mother died when she was 7, and Isabel has carried this sense that she should have been there when her mother died. But in fact, her mother died in the middle of the night, and, you know, as Benny said to her, you know, that may have been how she wanted it. I mean, you know, you were 7 years old, Isabel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And of course, that just creates more of a condition to be guilty about it, you know?
Yeah.
Did I really want it that way? Yeah. Should I feel bad about really wanting it that way?
I just realized something.
Yeah.
I hadn't quite realized how all these characters have this different forms of guilt. And I guess I would say right on the other side of guilt is simply sorrow. Guilt is the responsibility, is the sense of responsibility.
We all have sorrow and we're entitled to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, Benny, in his position at the Children's Hospital, his burden of guilt, besides being a nom, is a little boy named Dimitri. You want to tell us about Dimitri?
Yes. Dimitri, well, Benny recently, recently, Dimitri is a child who's died. He had leukemia. And so there, the specific sense of guilt was that Dimitri was very attached to Benny, and kept asking him, hey, sit and watch, you know, Sesame Street or whatever. And Benny says, of course I couldn't sit down, I was working. But what if I had just done that, something that simple, just sit with him for a minute and watched Bert and Ernie cutting up or whatever the heck he thought was so hilarious. I think this happens a lot, actually, when people, whether it's a child in a hospital that's not in your family or whether it's a family member, you think back to, what more could I have done? Could I have said more? Could I have? And I think, anyway.
That's certainly survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, what we have mentioned is the book actually takes place in 1974.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So all of this is really, Vietnam is really fresh in 1974.
I mean, definitely. Yeah. Very fresh. Because it was just over. The war was just over, and actually it wasn't fully over either.
Yeah. And this is the Nixon resignation happens, which is name checked in the book also.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
Benny and Isabel develop a relationship, nothing funny, you know, going on between them, but he starts driving her to work and they start talking to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to tell us about that?
Well, Benny's actually half aware that he is falling in love with Isabel, but she is his younger brother, Liam's girlfriend. It's a totally impossible situation. And in a way, I myself think he's just looking in the wrong direction. It's just that somehow she was able to break through to him in a way that he had been so almost like on an island. And it was almost as if she had gotten across to him. But he doesn't think there's any excuse for... by today's terms, what happens between them is so mild, but...
Well, it's innocent, really.
It's very innocent. It's very innocent. But in Bunny's mind, it's huge. It's gigantic, you know, that they do have this moment together in the car, a physical contact, an actual kiss. And I think about this a lot, actually. I think, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I wanted to give that a lot of weight and heft. I wanted it to feel very real. And no matter how I wrote it, it always did seem as if there was an innocence to it that Bunny isn't even aware of.
I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Harriet Scott Chessman. Her last name is spelled C-H-E-S-S-M-A-N. Title of her book is The Beauty of Ordinary Things, and it's published by Atelier 26 in Portland, Oregon.
Hey. Yes, wonderful, wonderful independent press. Let me give a shout out for them.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Oh, and Mark Cunningham is my publisher, and he is an amazing writer in his own right. I mean, he wrote a novel about Rilke called Lost Son, and he wrote The Green Age of Asher Witherow about...
great title.
It's a beautiful, lush, dark book about... a mining town at the foot of Mount Diablo in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hooray for small presses.
Yes, hooray for small presses. Yeah. And also he works with a wonderful designer, Nathan Shields, who's a local Oregonian also.
Do you want to talk about Tessa?
Tessa, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I don't know how much you want to give away about that. But.
You know, I think it's important to the book, actually, because I think you're talking about Benny's sense of guilt. Well, his original sorrow, I mean, really the thorn that is maybe never going to be able to be plucked out of his heart, is that his girlfriend Tessa in college got pregnant, and she was also Catholic, and he and she together hoped that it would somehow just vanish, but it didn't, and she had an, at that time, illegal abortion in 1969. And this is another thing I'm realizing now later, that often you would hear this story from the young woman's point of view. But in fact, I felt it was very important to this character, Benny Finn, that would have been his child. And that I think he right then, he after that, ever after that, not only does his relation to Tessa go very, very sour, it becomes haunted, really, by the might have been. And he goes off to Vietnam in that moment. That's when he just doesn't go back to school, and then he's drafted, and he doesn't fight the draft. And it's almost, I think it's a bit of a suicidal. I'm not saying that people who choose to go into war have that, but...
No, he's punishing himself.
He is. This particular character is kind of like, okay, basically, he is punishing himself. I never thought of it quite like that.
Yeah. Benny has recurring dreams of Vietnam.
Yes.
Which is not unusual, as we've come to know from the Iraq wars and the Afghanistan war. And his friend Mike Saltis, who is, among other things, a poetry lover. There's an undercurrent of poetry running in this book.
And, yes,
including, I mean, Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about him since high school.
I love Hopkins.
Yeah. What is there about Gerard Manley Hopkins that you like so much?
Oh, man.
Because your characters like him, too.
Yes, yes. His sense of language is extraordinary. I think Hopkins' work is uneven, but I think in his most beautiful poems, he just gets at something, either great, great joy or great, great despair. And he makes you feel it when you read the poetry. And it's beautifully crafted work, and it's... Sometimes it's a bit challenging, partly because of his sprung rhythm and all these. But I think there's a way in which he jumps right past your sense of logic and just dives right to the heart.
Do you, have you taken that as a model for yourself? Are you attempting to do something like that with your fiction?
Wow. I wish. I wish. That would, yes, that... Yes, actually, I think my deepest hope, my yearning, would be to dive straight to someone's heart, mm-hmm. to a reader's heart and soul through a kind of shape, the shaping of a story and the creating of something meaningful. I do think of books as, at their best, creating a kind of bridge from this fictional world, let's say, or a poem, directly to a reader.
It's easier for poetry, though, because it's so concentrated.
I mean, yes.
A novel can be hundreds of pages, and a poem is maybe dozens of lines.
Exactly.
And it's pretty much the TNT of
yes.
literature. I mean, it goes right there. So,
isn't it, though?
Yeah. And as far as Hopkins being uneven,
yeah.
I don't think I would like a poet who is always great.
You know what? I agree.
I mean, it's what
I agree.
Somebody once told me that only the mediocre are always at their best. You know, you have bad days and good days. Yeah, I like
that
a lot.
I never heard that.
Yeah. You have bad days and good days. You have good poems and bad poems. Bob
yes.
Dylan wrote a lot of really bad songs, but I still love Bob Dylan.
Oh,
so.
You know what? That's true. And I suppose in a funny way, a poet like Hopkins creates such a high bar, there's no way he could always reach that. I mean, and also,
and I'm sure he felt bad about that.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Let's talk about Benny visiting Sister Claire in New Hampshire. Now, why does he go
yeah.
there? And what does he find when he gets there?
So, originally, this was much, much smaller part of the book, but it became very important. It's after Mike Soltis. I guess I can say this, after Mike Soltis, his buddy from Vietnam, is no longer living, and Benny is desolate. I mean, there he's really at the heart of a Hopkins poem, you know, no worse, there is none. He's in great despair, and he doesn't want to go back to Boston to his own apartment where he's alone. He doesn't want to go to his family's place where everybody's cheerful and happy. And he suddenly realizes, I could go to that abbey, the place that Isabel goes. And he just starts driving up 91 and somehow finds it practically without a map. And yeah, I think it's at his greatest point of need. And he's startled. I mean, even once he's there in the parking lot, he thinks, why am I here? This is ridiculous. But he walks in the entrance and greets the nun who comes to the door.
Is that Sister Inez?
That's Mother Rita.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've forgotten which one was which. Sorry.
Named for a beloved friend of mine, actually.
Mm-hmm. That you can do that when you write a book.
Yeah.
Call people anything you like.
Yeah.
Benny's a photographer.
Yes.
And in a way, looking at the world through a lens
yeah.
gives him a way to redeem himself.
Definitely.
Can you talk about that?
He definitely feels... Actually, this is funny. I don't know how I can talk about that. That's interesting.
Okay.
No, it's more that I'm not sure I've articulated it to myself yet. But there is a way in which, let's say, the world seems filled with difficult things. Well, when you're holding a camera, you're actually shaping what you see. You're giving it shape and you're giving it meaning. When it may in itself seem to have only the most devastating meaning, let's say. Let's say you see an old woman with a bag lady, basically, by a dumpster. Well, that could be devastating just to think about what that is, who she is, what her life has been like. But if you take a picture and other people see it, I guess it's really about art. You're giving shape to something very important. You're giving shape and even beauty and letting other people see how you see that thing.
Yeah, on a very gross level, it's yeah. kind of a way of controlling the situation as well.
Yes, that's
when
probably
you capture
true.
It.
That's true.
I think
it's a bit, it's a distancing element in that
yes.
way too. Yeah, for sure.
But of course, the kind of eye you bring to your photographs tells a lot about you as well.
Yes.
And his
choice of subjects, for example.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, his choice of subjects here is an interesting one. It's
yeah.
It's Mother Heloise's gardens.
Yes.
And this is a project that Sister Claire is very interested in. Can you
yes.
talk about that a little bit?
Well, actually, in my mind, Sister Claire, together with Mother Heloise, comes up for something, a project for Benny Finn, because they sense that if only he can come back to this art, it will be a step for him on the way back to health. That doesn't emerge directly in the story, but in my mind, that's what it was. I mean, because since Vietnam, he's put away his camera. That he took a few, some photographs after he came back on a medical discharge because essentially he had a nervous breakdown, but essentially his camera's in a drawer. So the idea of photographing a garden would not necessarily have been something Benny would have chosen, but it has so much natural beauty and a sense of an implicit sense of growth. And also, I think he only agrees to do it because she says they could put those photographs in the gift shop and so earn money for this abbey.
This book describes in many ways people can love each other.
Yes.
And it goes from carnal love to a kind of an elevated, kind of love.
Yes.
And all the people in the book relate to each other in some way of loving one another, although not necessarily in the standard way. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
And also, at the end of the book, and I don't know if I should say this, but
yeah.
I will.
You can. Yeah. You can. Oh, no, it's fine.
As Sister Claire approaches her final vows,
yeah. The
doubts begin to creep in. And yes. We don't know what happens at the end of the book. You
yes. Have
left everything unresolved, which is, guess what?
Yes.
A lot like life, right?
Yes, so, exactly.
when you came to the end of this book, I mean, I assume that you may have started out with one idea about how the book was going to end. Did you wind up with the same idea?
Oh, my gosh, no. Actually, originally, I thought Benny was going to become a priest. But I worked and worked and struggled, and this character, this particular character, just was not going to become a priest. I also had another plot about when I thought the novel was done the first time, I thought that Benny and Isabel would be able to be together somehow in the future. I didn't have her marry Benny's brother Liam. I didn't have all that, and there was some door open. But I thought, because originally I think I was trying to write more of a conventional love story, actually. It's just that as I went, the seriousness of what Benny was coping with started becoming more important. And also, my sense is he would never have actually poached that way on his brother's, love life. And it just wasn't working for me. And long about then, I started developing this character of Sister Claire. And I myself see her as a character who really is going to find increasing balance and happiness in that abbey. I don't know if that comes across. I definitely wanted to leave it on an ambiguous note.
Yes, you did.
Partly because I actually do think that through the nuns that I do know, I don't think it's something that ever is wholly resolved. And I think that there is sorrow in the sense of what the choices you're making make other choices impossible, just as is the case in every way we live. It's just that it's so stark. It's that if you're a nun, for example, and you're a young nun who hasn't yet had children, you will not have children, for example. And so it's not as if, oh, okay, I'm fine with that because I'm so close to God and it's just not like that. I think there's daily doubt, maybe hourly doubt and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as she says, the sorrow of the world doesn't end.
Yeah, someone said that Jesus is a very neglectful husband of all of his wives.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and boy, that when I read that, I said, wow, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, so. Really, if you think about Christ as being like the bridegroom, where is he? But that's where I feel I am very interested in that notion, that idea of incarnation, in the sense that it's the person next to you, as this Mother Heloise says to Sister Claire. Why are you looking so far away for God? It's in the person next to you.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say I'm a little influenced by Judaism, actually. It's funny. I think if someone who knows me...
Well, it's full of guilt, so yeah.
Yeah. That too, but also that sense of why look so far away? Look to what you can do right now for the person on the street, the person next to you, the person at your table.
Having grown up as I did in New York in mixed Catholic Jewish neighborhoods.
No way. Oh, way, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You had guilt to spare.
The thing I finally decided is that Catholicism lacks Judaism's irony. Otherwise, they're exactly the same.
You know what? I think there's truth to that.
Yeah, the Jews have a sense of, almost in their DNA, in our DNA,
sense
of irony that, oh man, here we go again.
Yes, exactly. There's a bit more earnestness maybe in Catholicism.
And the thing is, you can always go and confess your sins and get rid of them.
Exactly. Well, you know, Yom Kippur, I mean, I really think that there's so much in Judaism that really is came first. But just that sense of, well, it's just once a year, though.
Yeah, just once a year, that's right. And if you miss it, you're screwed. So,
exactly.
It's really been fun speaking with you.
Oh, it's been great to speak to you, Ed. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our listeners once more that the title of the book is The Beauty of Ordinary Things, Harriet Scott Chessman, and it's published by Atelier 26. What are you working on now?
Actually, I'm working on a libretto for an opera.
Cool.
About Hugh Thompson, the helicopter pilot in My Lai, who intervened in the My Lai massacre. This is an opera being worked on by a friend of mine who's a wonderful composer, Jonathan Berger.
Please let us know what's going on with that. That's very interesting. This is a classical station after all. So
yes. Oh my gosh. Yes, I will. I will. Okay. It's hopefully he's going to finish the composition of it this summer. And we're hoping the Kronos Quartet will be
cool.
Yeah.
Really cool.
I'll definitely let you know.
Thanks very much, Harry.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed.
You've been listening to Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.